This time on Weather Brains, looking back at an unprecedented weather event in Alabama.
We had 31 tornadoes across just Alabama, Mississippi, and Georgia, according to my records. You hear things like, the town of Gwin has been wiped off the face of the earth.
We had no warnings. There was no such thing as a tornado warning in 1932. Whatever weather agency was going at that time, they were not allowed to use the word tornado.
That, plus you'll hear some opinions you probably won't hear while you're watching the local weather.
Nobody wants to do anything about it. The government wants to put their head in the sand and kind of ignore it because they don't want any liability thrust their way.
I think to a great extent, severe thunderstorm warnings are pretty much ignored.
If we issue a warning for every single little thing out there, and we're only getting a small percentage of them, are we starting to lose some of the gravity that a warning has?
That plus more coming up. Hello, I'm David Black for Weather Brains, the weather podcast about weather by a bunch of weather geeks. On this podcast, we've got J.B. Elliott, Bill Murray, and John Olshue. J.B., how are you doing this time?
I'm doing good, as long as the coffee holds out, and I just got another fresh cup, so I'm good.
Do you have any donuts by you, to be honest?
No donuts anywhere in the vicinity.
Anything forbidden in front of you besides the coffee?
Negative.
Okay. Bill Murray, where are you, sir?
Well, I am stationed in beautiful Foley, Alabama, just a few miles north of the beautiful beaches of Alabama.
For people who don't know much about your travel schedule, how much do you travel out of every month or year?
About 200 days a year.
Really?
David, we have business from Albuquerque, New Mexico to Baltimore, Maryland, so it carries me all over the United States.
You never get tired of traveling now, do you?
I always wanted to travel when I was a kid, so it's not a good thing to have to travel that much, but at least, you can go and kind of have a busman's holiday wherever you go, go and identify the cool places to eat or the neat attractions to see, learn a little about the history of each area. So that makes it fun to me.
And you do get to see a lot of the world, a lot of the U.S. anyway.
Yeah, I love it. We got a package today on a hotel in Billings, Montana, and I bet JB's been there 100 times, but I've never been to Billings, Montana, so I'm looking forward to going checking that out in a few weeks.
Yes, I've been there.
Yeah, JB, you've got a lot of time in across the western states, don't you?
Yeah, my wife's folks lived out west, so for many years we would go driving out every year. My wife's folks lived in Salt Lake City and in Phoenix, and for a time in Las Vegas. And so we did a lot of traveling out there. And I had folks in Denver and over in the Grand Junction, Colorado area. So we had some widely spaced stops we could stop in.
You've seen some pretty areas of the country, that's for sure. Well, one of the things that I wanted us to cover in this podcast, and by the way, we had some technical problems that keep us from bringing James Spann on board, but for folks who listen to our podcast, James is the chief meteorologist with the ABC television affiliate in Birmingham, Alabama, and he, of course, is a huge part of this, and we will have him back with us on the next podcast, but every now and then some technical glitches will take a swipe at us and occasionally nip us. But, JB, you posted a fascinating story on the ABC 3340 weather blog that I want to talk about. And for folks who are not familiar with the weather blog, again, I don't know how many people listen to us from the Birmingham, Alabama area and how many people listen from outside of the region. But on the website, abc3340.com, the weather blog is a real, I'd call it a treasure trove of weather information and history. And you made a post just recently about this week being a very key anniversary in Alabama's weather. And Bill Murray, you have some knowledge of this too. I can't say that I have any memories back from this year, but JB, tell me a little bit about what you can impart on this event.
Well, it happened 3 weeks before I was born, so I do not remember it happening, of course.
You neither,
but,
okay.
All down through weather history, of course, it's been a key element on the historic side of our weather of the past. And, of course, Bill specializes in things past with his weather calendar and weather notebook feature, so he knows all about it, too. But March 21, 1932 still stands out like a sore thumb as the worst day in history for Alabama tornadoes. Now, we do know about the super outbreak on April 3rd and 4th, 1974, which was a much wider space disaster covering much more of the country. But as far as Alabama was concerned, March 21, 1932, a Monday, was by far the worst.
Now, J.B., tell me, first off, where did you research this? How did you find out about all the history of this weather event?
Well, from Weather Service records, of course, I worked for the U.S. Weather Bureau and National Weather Service for 32 years, all in the Birmingham office. But I spent an entire day one time in downtown Birmingham at the main library reading those old microfilms of the old Birmingham H. Herald and Birmingham News and maybe even the Birmingham Post. I'm not sure. We had three daily papers for a long time. And there was just a wealth of information. So I researched it. I researched it not only the next day after it happened, but reading the newspaper files for up to a week or two afterwards and just gleaming all kinds of information out of that.
Bill, what did you find about this that was interesting?
Well, you know, as J.B. said, David, this is the worst day ever in Alabama weather history. As you know, the most fatalities for sure. And if you go back and look, three of the five deadliest tornadoes ever in Alabama and four of the 10 deadliest occurred on this date. You know, it was over 300 people lost their lives in Alabama. There probably were a lot more than that, you know, because as J.B. said, you know, he went back to the library, and I've done that, and I have about 1,000 note cards on this day. You know, that go back and look. And the fascinating thing to me is to look at the times. You know, this was the middle of the Great Depression. You know, in the United States, economic despair was, you know, terrible. And Birmingham was a relatively new city. It was less than 62 years old at that point. And, you know, so the Magic City, you know, was in the middle of the economic troubles that everyone else was in. You know, there were actually fears that communism was taking over the country. You know, FDR, Franklin Roosevelt, was just appearing on the political scene. You know, of course, civil rights was a struggle at that point in our state. And, you know, it's just fascinating to go back in those times. It's also fascinating to go back and look that just 3 weeks earlier, the Lindbergh baby kidnapping happened. And so, of course, the nation was enthralled with the, you know, the crime scene that was, you know, that occurred in New Jersey and all that. So it was a very fascinating time to be in the United States, of course. But this outbreak didn't just affect Alabama. It affected areas as far north as Indiana and, you know, and as far Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia were some of the hardest hit states, with Alabama being the absolute hardest. But we had 31 tornadoes across just Alabama, Mississippi, and Georgia, according to my records. And 36 of the tornadoes in the total outbreak were F2 or greater, making them, you know, significant tornadoes. That's a lot. And 10 of them were violent tornadoes, either F4. And I think they were all F4s, actually. I don't think there were any F5s that day. But one of the worst ones in Alabama, of course, came across the northwestern side of Tuscaloosa, across the Warrior River, and devastated the downtown area of Northport. That happened about 4 o'clock. And I've heard descriptions that it, you know, looked like a giant white ice cream cone as it crossed there. So,
goodness.
That tornado was probably one of the worst of the day. The tornadoes kind of came in two waves, according to my memory, you know, affecting kind of north central Alabama and then shifting down into, you know, shifting up into the Tennessee Valley later in the night. And JB, you remember we went and interviewed a gentleman down in that lived near Plantersville, I think, last year. For the storm alert tour. So, Dave, you might want to get JB to share some of that.
Yeah, and also, at some point, I'd like to know what the warning system was like in 1932.
There were non-existent.
That's what I feared.
Virtually non-existent. And like Bill said, both of the two worst outbreaks in Alabama history, as far as tornadoes is concerned, they came in two waves. In the 1932 outbreak, the first wave started at mid-afternoon in west central Alabama near Demopolis, and then another wave after dark. And that happened, too, in the super outbreak of 1974, April 3rd and 4th, 1974. We had some vicious tornadoes touch down in northwest Alabama before dark, and another wave later in the evening. In fact, possibly even sort of a third wave up toward 10 and 11 o'clock at night affecting the Huntsville area.
And I think, David, that people across central Alabama, that down in Chilton County, Shelby County, up across Sylacauga and those areas, probably remember this outbreak as much as any other one. I remember as a child, you know, traveling, like, to the beach like we did tonight here, coming down Highway 31, you know, and you saw lots of storm cellars and storm pits. And I think those were probably an offshoot of that 1932 outbreak that people remembered for a very, very long time.
So really what you did is if the weather just was threatening, you just headed to the cellar because that's as much advance notice as you had.
Unfortunately, that's exactly right. This gentleman that, and JB, his name escapes me right now. Maybe you remember, but it's a terrible story because he and his brother were the only people that survived out of a family of about 9 people, I think, JB. Maybe you remember exactly, but, you know, their only warning was to, you know, see the tornado coming over the, you know, over the ridge right behind their house.
And the thing about the difference in the two disasters, parts of central Alabama that were devastated in 1932 were left untouched by the 1974 wave of tornadoes, places like Sylacauga and Talladega County and Coosa County.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting when we get closer to April 3rd because that'll be our first podcast. We'll have to dedicate an entire entire session to that because I remember that night as clearly as if it were yesterday. Even though it occurred, you know, some 32 years ago, I remember that night as clearly as if it were today.
What kind of devastation did these storms leave? You guys know?
Total.
Yeah, the deadliest tornado was a tornado that passed from Perry to Coosa County, I think. According to Tom Grizulis and Significant Tornadoes, it killed 49 people.
Wow.
And that's the deadliest one ever in Alabama. 21 of those died in Perry County, including... 21 died in Perry County, and another 21 died in Jemison alone. So, you know, that was probably the deadliest tornado of the day. And by my notes, another F4 tornado, because that was an F4, after having seen 38 fatalities in Chilton County, you know, an hour later, another tornado paralleled that that first track, passing about 7 or 8 miles southeast of the first one, and saw another 31 people die. So if you can imagine, you know, that many people dying in two tornadoes that closely in parallel with each other, the situation must have been horrendous. I remember looking at Birmingham News reports, about 6 o'clock, the extent of the disaster became apparent back in Birmingham. And, of course, you know, there were calls that were sent out to all the doctors and ambulances to come south and help. And it was a very chaotic night across central Alabama. And as JB said, then additional tornadoes formed later that night, across the Tennessee Valley. There was a family of violent tornadoes that, you know, touched down in Morgan County and cut a 75-mile swath into Tennessee. And it killed 38 people, making it, you know, also one of the, actually, if you looked, if all those fatalities that occurred in Alabama, that would be the fourth deadliest storm in our state's history. But because some of them occurred in Tennessee, actually crossed the state line, you kind of put it in that special category.
This sounds like the world was coming to an end for people in Alabama back then. Horrible event.
Well, you know, it probably, the knowledge wasn't as widespread. But, you know, David, that night of April 3rd, 1974, that... JB's talking about that was a night when I felt like the world was coming to an end. The reports were so phenomenal. You know, you had these, when you'd read the tornado warnings, you know, you'd hear them on the radio. They would say, you know, the tornado's a mile wide, taking everything in its path. You know, you hear things like, you know, the town of Gwin has been wiped off the face of the earth. These sort of things, you know, make an impression on you when you're 12 years old.
Absolutely.
And I really to bed that night thinking that I would not wake up the next morning. So I know that people back in 1932 must have been terrorized.
While we continue talking about this weather history for Alabama, severe weather history, let's welcome another member of the Weather Brains team joining us, and that is John Olshue. Hello, J.O.
Hey, guys. Can you all hear me all right there?
You're doing great. We're sitting here. I'm hearing some fascinating stories out of J.B. and Bill Murray about the Alabama weather tragedy of 1932, and I tell you what, when you look at where we are today and compare it to what people had to endure back then, it's amazing, unbelievable.
You must remember there were no such things as television stations back in 1932 and very few radio stations. They were widely spaced. Of course, there were some in Birmingham and Tuscaloosa, but a lot of the small county seats that have radio stations now did not have them back then, and we had no warnings. There was no such thing as a tornado warning in 1932.
I guess you just looked at the sky, huh?
Yeah, whatever weather agency was going at that time, they were not allowed to use the word tornado. because they were afraid.
Not many people know that, JB.
And that was a forbidden word.
A ban by the Weather Bureau, and you know, it lasted for decades, and that's just amazing to us today.
They were afraid it would cause panic and cause more of a problem than actually the warning would help.
And this weekend also marked an important date in terms of that. I don't know if you read the blog that I posted. I think Sunday, it was the anniversary of Faubush and Miller.
Yeah.
Issuing the first tornado forecast, for a tornado that actually hit Tinker Air Force Base in Oklahoma City back in 1948. And it really was, just sort of by luck for us that it actually verified, because they had a tornado 2 days before. They looked at the conditions on the weather maps, and 2 days later they saw the very same conditions. So they went out on a limb and issued, what was called a tornado forecast. And the base prepared, and they really, at the end of the day, they thought that they had just missed the forecast when they found out that this huge Air Force base, a tornado had touched down, and because they had prepared, there was a savings in terms of damage.
Good call, John. When you look at the, you spend a lot of time researching tornadoes. Do you see just a little bit of progress, maybe from those years past, to what you guys do today?
That's a great question. I'll tell you what I notice from all of that, and I kind of use my own childhood and some of those stories that Bill and JB have been talking about. When I grew up during the 70s, and there was a tornado warning, and those two events that we've been talking about in the 70s are crystal clear in my head, even though I was very small then. You know, it seems like when we had a tornado warning, it really meant a lot, and let me put this in perspective for you. There was a meeting of the kind of meteorologists in town. We do an NWA meeting, and I wasn't at it, but James told me a little bit about it. That when they came back from it, they had analyzed the FAR, the false alarm rate that they've been getting around in the region, and it was a fairly high percentage. That's how many times, or what is the percentage where they've warned for a tornado and there actually has not been a tornado on the ground.
Wow.
I think there's a disconnect there, and that's where you have to balance it. If we issue a warning for every single little thing out there, and we're only getting a small percentage of them, are we starting to lose some of the gravity that a warning has? And so I say we're much better at seeing things with the radar. There's something, though, that we've got to work better towards translating that to the public. Maybe some more filters that we have to do, better studies. I don't know. But I'm just telling you from my personal opinion, from what happened during the 70s, when I can remember the warning as plain as day. It was like one of those old test patterns. It would come on the cable in Tuscaloosa, and it would have this awful sound to it. And then JB's voice would come on, and it would be, a tornado warning, and you knew something was going on.
There was no doubt.
Right. And granted, most of the time with the radar technology back then, it was going to be a major tornado for them to be able to see it on radar, F3, F4, F5. Now, when we're trying to hit F0s and F1s, and something's not being communicated to the public. And I think we've got to really work on that, or we're just going to lose them.
That's a very good analysis, John.
Yeah, and I know that the concern is that people are just hearing so many severe thunderstorm warnings, among others, that they're just kind of not really hearing them anymore.
Right.
I think to a great extent, severe thunderstorm warnings are pretty much ignored. People, of course, pay attention to them, but with not near the priority they do a tornado warning. So,
well, there's this great debate, JB, with both severe thunderstorm warnings and tornado warnings, if you don't break those apart. And with severe thunderstorm warnings, we set a higher criteria for a super severe thunderstorm warning or something. Maybe the wind speeds we think are over 75 miles per hour instead of 58 miles per hour. And with tornadoes, I think we ought to start trying to say, okay, F0, F1, F2 is one category, F3, F4, F5 is another category, or what we believe the tornado is. Because everybody in this phone conversation can look at a radar picture and say, that's going to be an F3, F4, F5, or it's going to be one of the weaker tornadoes. Why don't we communicate that to the public, and then maybe we can get the false alarm rate for the F3, F4, F5s to only be in 10 or 20%, and and then we can deal with the other problems. But I think we're trying to hit these very minute areas of or very small areas of rotation, and I just don't know if we're serving the public with that. You know, that's just my opinion. I mean, we try to warn for tornadoes that have a, you know, or 50-yard, you know, have a 50-yard path that goes for, you know, 3 football fields, 300 yards, and knocks over a chicken coop. I mean, what are we serving the purpose there when we might also be able to use that same warning and give it more gravity for the major tornadoes, and then people won't be confused, or maybe it's going to confuse them more, but I just, something's got to be done about it.
And there has been talk of adding a declaration such as tornado emergency when one is on the ground causing serious damage.
Right.
I don't know what the answer is there.
It seems like we've been talking about it for the last 10 years since I've been in the business, but nobody wants to do anything about it. The government wants to put their head in the sand and kind of ignore it because they don't want any liability thrust their way or whatever. And you know,
I think you hit the nail on the head right there.
Yeah,
I mean, John, I think that it's a case of just making sure that you cover your rear end and that you don't miss any of them.
Right.
I think that's exactly right. You inconvenience and scare a lot of people, and you know that there's a waste of time and effort and money during that time. That I think you're exactly right.
What if we got 100% of the major tornadoes and 75% of the weak tornadoes and reduced our false alarm rate to 30%? If that was a good equation, I would go for it. What's going to happen, though, is you're going to get some EMA manager and some of the ones in the northern part of this state. I'm not going to name any names, but somebody's going to go crazy when the National Weather Service doesn't warn for that F0 tornado that knocks over that chicken coop.
Absolutely.
And unfortunately, it's part of why we have a second National Weather Service office in the northern half of the state of Alabama right now.
Yes, that's
because
a great
of
story.
An event that happened, you know, 9, 10 years ago.
And let me ask you guys something that sort of ties into this. This is sort of a different subject, but then again, it's part of this subject too, and that is, how do you handle issuance of warnings by others than other than the Weather Service? Does that not open a door to confusion if somebody's issuing a warning that the Weather Service is not issuing a warning for?
I'll just say personally, I've never seen anywhere another warning come from anywhere that I would even pay any attention to. I don't know the other. You may be talking about one of the big private weather firms in the Northeast called AccuWeather. But I don't know, Bill. Do they issue warnings?
I don't think so.
Except to their private customers.
I'm just thinking of different. I'm thinking of just different television meteorologists in various markets who might choose to do that.
There was a situation in Oklahoma City quite a few years ago where one TV station took it on themselves to start issuing their own warnings, and it caused mass confusion.
Because the Weather Service was not issuing warnings at the same time?
Well, you know, I've commented on Gary England before, you know, at one of the stations there in Oklahoma City, and I think he stays in hot water with the Weather Service from time to time because, you know, sometimes he'll call a spade, like as John was referring to, say, there's no sense in there being a tornado warning for this. Of course, the Weather Service doesn't want that. They want, you know, everyone to speak with one voice, and he'll make it clear that there's no sense in worrying about this storm. Or he might come out and say, hey, there's no formal tornado warning, but, you know, I think we better worry about this storm.
Heck, we do that here. James and I do that without any problem. I have no problem with that. Listen, I don't. Sometimes you've just got to step back and say, I don't know what they're thinking, but A, that storm's gone. There's no reason continuing with this warning. Or B, here's this hook. It looks like an F3 tornado. It's about to cross the county line. I don't know if they're twiddling their thumbs, but I'm going to go ahead and tell the next county, get ready. You know, I'm sorry, we're not a bureaucracy. We're a TV station, and we use a lot of what the government sends us, but we're not going to put our viewers in jeopardy or put them in undue danger just because somebody wants to hold their breath for another 30 seconds to decide to issue a warning or not.
Well, I think we have a unique stage to speak from, John, with, you know, the audience that's there for especially our television station in Birmingham, you know, where we're, you know, just literally, you know, the audience that is interested in weather is glued to that station. Yeah. And the coverage is phenomenal whenever there's wall-to-wall, you know, coverage. For anybody around the country, get a chance to look at it. You know, on our website, there's, you know, streaming coverage when there's tornado warnings. And I'd put it up against anywhere in the country. But, you know, there's objective, clear analysis and information going straight to the consumer there.
Absolutely.
You know,
yeah.
Who know
Let me
what
say
they're
one
doing.
Other thing, Bill, real quick, because I know we probably have the guys from the Weather Service in Birmingham listening. I say that, but let me say, they are also the best office I know of in the nation. They spearheaded the IM project that is now used right. by a number of Weather Service offices, and we have the best communication channel with any Weather Service office in the nation. So it is very rare that there's that instance where we have to say, hey, don't worry about this storm, or hey, go ahead and worry about this storm, because usually they're communicating right with us what's going on. So let me put that disclaimer out there. We love them. I don't want them to be mad at me. They do the best job, I think, of any Weather Service office in the nation.
And in the past, there really wasn't that much communication in the past because we didn't have the technology.
Right. And it's funny. I mean, a lot of these, I don't know if a lot of the people who are listening to this know, but there was this wonderful kind of enlightenment at the National Weather Service and also at the TV stations that, hey, if we open up the computers, not call each other, because that's very hard to handle a phone and make a lot of decisions at the same time, but if you had a computer screen up where we could communicate with each other during these severe weather events, we both serve each other a lot better. And we started doing that, I guess it's been 4 or 5 years ago, and it's the best thing in the world. It's we basically used to use Yahoo Instant Messenger up until about a year ago, and then they went to another platform, but it works the same way. And we just communicate. All the TV stations sit in a conference with the National Weather Service, and if they start looking at a storm, they say, hey, we're looking at this storm, and then they'll say, we're writing up the warning, a tornado warning for this county, and that allows us to go on about a minute and a half or 2 minutes earlier than we would have had been able to, because we know they've already made the decision. We're just waiting on the text of the warning, and I think it serves the public a lot better too.
And those seconds count, don't they, John?
They sure do. And it, you know, out of when we talk about all the investments in technology that we do to increase the warning lead time, that was a $0. It cost zero tax dollars.
Amazing.
And it added an extra 2 minutes in warning time. So
yeah,
tremendous sharing of information now.
Yes.
Yeah, it's phenomenal, even on an event like last night. You know, just the amount of information available to us is just phenomenal.
It's helping the broadcasters, obviously, but also I'm sure that it's a great thing to the forecasters, because, JB, I've seen you on before on the chats, the weather, severe weather chats, where a listener might make an observation that's relevant, and you can get that to the Weather Service very quickly instead of having to go through a telephone route or something.
Yeah, often I do wall-to-wall radio weather coverage when there's a tornado warning here in this general area for Jefferson and surrounding counties. And quite often, we have developed a habit of inviting calls from the radio listeners, and a tremendous number of our listeners are in their automobile and are driving through some of that adverse weather. And we've had a number of times when they would call and report severe weather in progress. So I could type with one hand and get that information to the Weather Service and all the other guys, so it's very helpful.
John, this brings up a subject I wanted to ask you about. We got email from a Weather Brains podcast listener, Stephen, in Birmingham, wrote us and asks, what do meteorologists do in the office during nice weather? Do you plan forecasts and do prep work for future weather events, brush up on your skills, etc.? Just curious. You want to answer him, John?
You know, what I do, I'm kind of the idea guy. I really like playing with all different types of technology and trying to improve our weather coverage. So if it's a quiet day in the weather office, and let's say James is doing his forecast, if he has any questions or wants to consult, of course we'll do that. But most of the time, you know, he's got his idea, and I don't want to disrupt him. What I'll be doing is playing with different technology. The whole eWarn's a good example. David, you and I worked on eWarn. That took considerable months to build as a computer platform, at least on my side. David and I split it up, just for everybody out there. eWarn is a service that mails emails, warnings, to not only pagers and cell phones, but also your email address, and does it relatively quickly. And David built kind of the warning side, and I built the email side. And they both have
to work together.
That's right, and they both have to be really fast for it to make a difference for anybody. So what we had to do is, at least on my side, we had to build an email system that was capable of putting out about 10,000 pieces of email in about 5 minutes. And so, to give you an example, that took about a year of playing around, learning the system, tweaking it the right way, and then working with David and a number of other programmers. So little projects like that are usually what I'm working on.
And I don't know how you do that, John. I'm just glad that that's your end of eWarn, and I don't have to worry about it, because I don't know how you make it work. You do, though, so anyway. Where do you guys see the whole issue with warnings going in the next couple of years as far as the false alarm ratio? Any ideas, thoughts, predictions there?
Well, the things I've seen David say, there's not going to be a tremendous improvement. Maybe just a few points in each regard, the false alarm rate and the probability of detection, which are the two main things you're checking. They're only going to improve by 4 or 5 points probably in the next decade. So that's not any quantum improvement for sure.
You think we'll see any real changes in criteria for warnings?
We have been pushing for that for quite a few years at the Mississippi State Southeast States Severe Weather Symposium a couple of years ago. I held up my hand and asked if that could be possible to change the criteria for a severe thunderstorm to increase the hail size to 1 inch in diameter and the wind gust. As it stands now, 58-mile-an-hour wind gust, 50 knot, triggers a severe thunderstorm warning, and I was suggesting increasing that peak gust to at least 65 miles an hour. And there was a guy from the Storm Prediction Center present at the symposium, and he said they would frown on that greatly because it would dilute the database, the long-term database.
Wait a minute. In other words, they don't want to just have a change in data? That's what they're against?
Yeah, the statistics,
the history.
The stats using the new criteria of 65 miles an hour and 1 inch hail would not be comparable with the earlier statistics.
Yeah, I don't know if I'd go for that.
It's not like every single year that we don't break a new record for tornadoes almost, because we see more of them, we detect more of them, and it's just a different ballgame.
That's the whole problem. You guys know me. I'm kind of an entrepreneur. And that's the problem I have a lot with some of these policies. I guess in entire government, and here it applies to the National Weather Service, nobody's willing to say, oh, yeah, let's do that. They may not even know who can do that. That's the thing. So you usually have all these guys who are sitting around, and you're talking with them, and, hey, wouldn't it be great if we changed some of the warning criteria? And they may agree with you, but nobody has any idea how to do it. And they would be scared for their jobs if they went and suggested it to whoever it was higher above them. So
it's a big, scary bureaucracy.
It is a big, scary bureaucracy. I love our National Weather Service office, though. They, out of all the Weather Service offices in the nation, they're one of the most proactive. Like I said, they spearheaded this IM project. They've been great with the media. We meet with them constantly. So don't let me... It applies to everybody else except the Birmingham office. How about that?
We should probably mention that we do tend to give a lot of our own opinions here, and we should probably just clarify and say that those are our opinions, and even though most of the WeatherBrains members have connections to ABC 3340, those opinions are strictly those of the speakers and not of the television station, so we don't want to get anybody in hot water.
Yes, take note, lawyers. Disclaimer.
And John Olshue's mailing address for the subpoena is, yeah. What again would that be, John?
That would be Washington, D.C., the federal building.
Anything else you guys want to cover?
We do know that sometimes a thunderstorm that produces 50-mile-an-hour wind gusts can cause some damage, whereas the same thunderstorm producing 65 miles an hour wind at another time would not cause damage. A lot of that has to do with whether or not the trees have leaves on them or not. In the wintertime, especially if the ground is dry, it takes a whole lot more wind to uproot a tree than it does in the summertime when the leaves act like an umbrella. And I guess there's a sort of a slight fear in the back of everyone's mind that if a summer thunderstorm blows down 10 or 15 trees when it would not in the wintertime, that the public would be all over us for not warning.
I think what we're going to see here are two pieces of technology that are going to allow people to get the weather information they want. Listen, some people want to hear about every single severe thunderstorm, where it's going, what type of damage it's doing. Some people don't even want to know if there's a tornado warning for their house. And up until now, we haven't been able to separate those two groups, okay? But as we get into the new digital HD TV, we'll be able to split the channels apart. So we'll have normal programming playing on one channel, and we'll have weather coverage on another channel. And I think you'll even see more of that as we go forward into what they call IPTV, which is going to allow for an unlimited number of channels, probably 5 to 10 years in the future. And basically, at that point, you probably won't hear any griping from the public anymore because everybody will get to tune in to what they want to see.
It's going to be an amazing future technologically, yeah. Isn't it?
Yeah.
All right, guys. It's been an interesting show. We've had a lot of fun. I want to thank all of you for being a part of it. We also want to let our podcast listeners know that we really enjoy seeing email from you. And if you feel inspired to send something to any of us, maybe you want to make a comment about John's editorializing or JB's editorializing or something Bill said tonight for that matter, we'd love to hear from you. Our email address is question@weatherbrains.com. So just fire off an email to question@weatherbrains.com and we'd love to see it. That's our show for this time. We do thank you for listening. For Bill Murray, JB Elliott, and John Olshue, I'm David Black with the Weather Company from Birmingham, Alabama. We'll see you next time for more Weather Brains. Weather Brains is copyright 2006, all rights reserved. See ya.